Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I'm very happy to be back at Abhayagiri Monastery to see the development here and pay respects to Lumpa Pasano and meet again brothers in the holy life and some of the lay people I know well who have come, and it's always a pleasure to enter into a space where Dhamma practice is held high as something that's valuable and worthwhile, and then effort is being made to live according to the principles of Dhamma. And it creates a kind of energy, a certain atmosphere, and I think people can sense it, feel it in one way or another, even if they've never been to a monastery before, even if they've never considered or heard Buddhist teachings. It's not necessarily even a Buddhist thing per se, but any place where there are beings who are focusing on deepening into a way of awareness of what's happening, rather than simply reacting according to habit and living on automatic pilot, those places start to exude a certain vibration, certain atmosphere, and that's something we can tune into once we do ourselves develop meditation and start to appreciate the capacities of the mind. So most of us here have probably come to Dhamma practice out of an interest in deepening our hearts, deepening the mind. There can be other reasons too. We can sometimes have family events that bring us to a monastery, either a death in the family or a friend or a relative who joins a monastic community or lives at a monastery. But most of us have come because of our own interest in meditation and deepening the heart. And we come from different places. We're different ages, we have different backgrounds, different cultures, and we come into a practice which is, it's universal in its most fundamental sense, because it applies to each of us in the same way. And yet the way that we experience it and what's going to be helpful at any particular time can be quite unique and quite varied and quite personal. And we won't always hear the same thing at the same time in our own life, our own practice, even if it's the same words, the same teaching. Sometimes when we are ready, then it can land. It can actually show us something which it fails to do at other times. And that's always true for each one of us as we practice the path, and it's true because that's the case. You know, those of us who live in community in a place like this where different people are coming together to practice as a community, both monastic community, lay community, and the kind of community that arises in a monastery like this, in our tradition, it's incumbent upon us to be patient and compassionate and open-minded to everyone around us who's also, like us, trying their best to integrate a practice which in its essence may be simple, may be universal, but is actually extremely difficult. It's not difficult in terms of it being complicated. Actually, it's very simple. But it's difficult because it goes against the grain of our habits, and it challenges our views and our opinions and our perceptions. And because we're so involved in needing to feel okay. Just naturally, we want to feel okay. We want to feel happy at a very deep level. This will have its expression in all kinds of ways. The kilesas, the various expressions of greed, of aversion, of delusion, will manifest in our lives in unique and very powerful ways. It's hard to go against that stream. And a lot of that's around, yes, the things we normally notice, like our desire for yummy food, or our desire for comfort, or our, you know, wish to go sea kayaking, or whatever, however it might express itself at any particular time for different individuals. But, you know, most deeply and powerfully, and perhaps not so obviously, it expresses itself in terms of our views of the world, our views and opinions, our perceptions, who I am, and who you are, what the world is. These things are also very much affected by our wish to feel happy, our wish to feel okay, and our search for this. So we have a practice guidance given to us by the Buddha and carried over the centuries by many generations. And here we are also able to take up this opportunity to use universal teachings to train ourselves. And that word training is really closer to what the Buddha talked about rather than practice, perhaps. Because it is a training. It's something we need to keep at and apply ourselves to and get it wrong and then see how we've got it wrong and then try again and get it wrong again and then try again. And just like learning any kind of skill, we need to be patient and we need to apply ourselves over and over again. And that's why, of course, one of the reasons, perhaps, one of the most fundamental reasons why you'll have a monastery with a monastic community and the various routines and practices and etiquette and the training that's offered in a communal environment, why we have that as such a fundamental part of our tradition. Because it's hard to do it on our own. It's hard to do it in a context where most people around us are simply following habit and living on automatic pilot. It's wonderful to see that these days there's a lot of interest in developing awareness. In fact, I don't even know what the word mindfulness means anymore, because it's used by so many people in so many contexts, in so many ways. And that's a good thing. You know, it may be a fad right now, the mindfulness craze, and yet that's not a bad thing, to have a fad that's focused on awareness and deepening. And it means that there is more and more cultural awareness of a need for something beyond, of course, material achievement and happiness. And perhaps a need for a rebalancing, perhaps a recognition how sick we are, in a sense, as a culture and a people, just madly going from one thing to the next in a world where that's becoming increasingly easy with the technology we have now and the development we've achieved. It gives us a lot of power as a people, as a human community, and that it's like giving a chainsaw to a drunk. You can do a lot of good things with a chainsaw, but you want to make sure you're sober when you're using it. And you know, our community now on the planet is getting really powerful. We have nuclear weapons. We can do all kinds of things with nanotechnology and biotechnology and probably kinds of technology we haven't even heard of yet. And yet, most of us as a whole are most of the time not deeply aware. We're following our reactions, wanting and not wanting and wanting and not wanting, and seeing the world through perceptions and views and opinions formed by those forces of not wanting and not wanting and wanting to feel happy, wanting to feel okay. And the many and various ways that we try to address this feeling of lack, some of them more skillful than others. In the end, when we really come down to it, it has to involve a deepening of awareness. It has to involve the kind of deepening which a practice of mindfulness supports. And of course, the training that we have and the teaching that we have handed down to us by the Buddha is one where we're not just simply trying to be mindful, but we're also bringing in all of our experience and all of our life to a so that it becomes part of a process of letting go and of insight, of wisdom. And so it needs to involve our relationships, it needs to involve what we do, what we say, eventually, you know, what we think, how much involved we get in the kinds of thoughts that arise. Because our minds, you know, we try to think the right thoughts, but that becomes, it's a disaster if we're just trying to think the right thoughts all the time. After a while, we realize that actually right thought is more about having the capacity not to believe the wrong thoughts that are coming up constantly. You know, so much is happening, and we're conditioned in a particular way, and so it's natural for us to have all kinds of thoughts that are not the right thoughts, inappropriate thoughts, the wrong feelings, the wrong emotions. And getting into practice like this, we can make the mistake of thinking we must become the perfect practitioner. We must become the one that always thinks the right thoughts and has the right emotions. And then if we do that without wisdom, we start to fight ourselves. We fight the one that has the wrong emotion. That's not me. That's the wrong me. And either we get depressed because we're not feeling the way we think we should feel, or we bury it and don't see it anymore and are blind to what we're pushing down. So awareness and mindfulness and the practice of concentration that supports this deepening of mind must involve compassionate acceptance of ourselves and of what we're experiencing, what we're feeling, what we're thinking, as we are, as it is in this moment. So this process, which is simple in its essence, becoming more aware and learning how not to just simply react and blindly to our emotions and our thoughts and our wants and our aversions. Simple though it is difficult because it goes so deeply against the grain of how we've learned to live. We've learned to live by being the me I want to be and trying to achieve that and make it known so that others recognize me in the way that I want to be seen and so that I can see myself in the way that I want to see myself. The practice of Dhamma is one where we do need to learn humility. And if we don't do it willingly, it'll be forced upon us unless we stop practicing. I've often thought of the practice as being a kind of a conscious, benevolent humiliation where you're just always getting egg on your face and more allowing yourself to accept that that's not wrong. And it's, in fact, a wise and healthy thing not to try to make it different, just to allow oneself to fail, allow oneself to be seen the wrong way, and see what that does, and not just jump into trying to fix it. It's not that we, you know, want to go around as failures. It's not about the failure of success, but it's about seeing where our sense of well-being comes from, where our sense of identity is, and trying to make a shift from how we perceive ourselves and how others perceive us, how we perceive the world, how the world perceives us, a shift from getting that right to getting right instead just simply the response to what's happening in this moment now. So if somebody's seeing us in the wrong way, how do we respond to that with wisdom? And that's something which we can do through thought, we can do with right thought, we can do with right speech, we can do with right action. Often it's just simply not doing anything at all. But when it starts to deepen, it's very subtle. It's something where we learn as we observe ourselves, observe our life, and meditate, that unless we can really see the mind working quite carefully in the present moment, then we are still getting caught in one way or another. We're only catching it after it's already caught us. So allowing the mind to quieten down is something we really start to value, not for the achievement of pleasant meditation states, although those can be very pleasant and they can be very beneficial, but because we see that we're going to continue to be reactive, we're going to continue to be caught in our ideas, in our views, in our opinions on some level, even if it's a more subtle and more subtle level, until we're able to really just stay quiet, watch ourselves as we live our lives in the present moment, always balanced with our hands off from the reactive process, how we just identify with emotion, identify with perception, identify with the body, identify with thought. So using the teachings then becomes something which can help us do something, yes, simple, but very difficult. We can use the body as a way to rest our awareness on something in the present moment, which is not part of the stories that our perceptions are creating. We can use body, we can use feeling, we can use perception itself, seeing how the mind labels things, perceiving a person as a person, perceiving the sky as the sky, the earth as the earth, but then more complicated than that, all the sankhara, the fabrications, proliferations we put on top of that, the stories, the sky which is blue and I love it and I wish it was always like this, or the sky which is gray and reminds me of England and it makes me depressed, or the sky which is, and fill in the blank. All of us are always perceiving and adding and adding and adding our stories to our perceptions all the time. So this is something which we can analyze, but much more usefully if we can start to quieten the mind so that we notice how we're adding to what's happening all the time, adding, 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 adding our stories, our history, you, who you are, me, who I am. We can start to notice it happening. It's not that we stop it happening. It's natural. We'd be zombies if it didn't happen, or vegetables in a coma. But we start to notice. We notice the stories we make, and we stop believing them because we notice that actually the story I make about me is different this morning when somebody says one thing to me than it is now when somebody says a different thing to me. I'm a different me. How many me's are there? It's infinite. The stories we're telling about other people, who the work monk is when he tells me to do, this task and I don't want to do it, or who, this layperson is when he or she praises me and I think, oh, that's nice. I must be a good monk. Or the stories when you hear somebody saying something which you think is critical and you think, oh, dear, yep, I'm a bad monk. And then you think this, and then you think that, and we just go through our lives thinking this and feeling that and feeling this and thinking that, and it's exhausting. So finding that place of balance where we can rest and be still and watch, the body can be our friend in that way, because the body is just the body. It's just here, supporting us, doing our work. It's like a good pet, doing its best, gets sick sometimes, but it's pretty good, actually. We say get up, it generally gets up. We say move, it moves. It's a good friend, the body, and it's not creating stories. So if we start resting our awareness on the body, the feelings of the body, even the perception of the body, although that's something we do need to look at, we can learn a lot. We can learn a lot about stillness and the possibility of stillness within movement, the movement of our life, as we relate, as we try, as we achieve or fail, as we go through whatever we're going through. As lay people or as monks, we generally have the same goal, nibbana. Nibbana or bust. There was a little cartoon we had on the bulletin board at Chittorst before. Nibbana, that's where we're going. And so we have ideas about how to get there and how we should be in order to get there. And unless we really do learn to see those ideas as ideas and to see our expectations of ourselves for what they are, we're going to continue to suffer and be fooled by our thoughts and opinions and views and perceptions until we can see them just as that. So using the teachings to be able to find a stillness where we are accepting of our minds and bodies, our emotional states, our perceptions, as they are, without needing to become the perfect me, the perfect monk, without any desire, or however we perceive the perfect monk to be, or the perfect practitioner to be, but we can simply allow ourselves to be as we are and know that that's not wrong. It's just perception, emotion, feeling, thought, and there is that which then knows the perception, knows the emotion, that which knows the body, feeling and thought. We start to get to know that which knows and see that that which knows is not emotion, it's not thought, it's not feeling. That which knows is always still and it's always present. It's what, when we practice mindfulness and concentration, where it all comes down to one point, is that which knows is always still. And it's not me, it's not part of the stories, it's not the world, it's not you, it's not mine, it's not old, it's not male, it's not female, it's not a monk or a lay person, it's not an it. We can't find anything there. And yet, when we do start to get familiar with the quality of knowing that's at the center of the heart, it's something which can take us to peace, a peace which is always there within the movement of life. All the hopes and dreams and achievements and failures and frustrations and ecstasies, the movement up and down and round, we can allow it to go up and down and round, it doesn't have to get still. The noise can be there. It might be noisy, might be quiet, might be sunny, might be rainy, and yet there's always the knowing, and it's always still, and it's always here. In fact, more close than anything else, which is joy, then we can find it's possible to rest there. It's possible to be the knowing until we can get to the point where we even don't have to be that at all. Because that being is part of the problem, we can start to see I am, I am, I am. First, I am me. I am the good me. I am the bad me. I am the monk me. I am the fill in the blank. Then I am knowing. I am the one that watches. I am the one that witnesses. I am. And in the end, just that starts to be painful. And we can start to see that there's no need even for that. Just a quiet, allowing, equanimous letting go. The letting go that we can't just do it because we want to do it, but which has to happen as a result of a process that we've committed ourselves to. One that's simple in its essence and very difficult because it goes against the grain. And so a place like this at Abhayagiri and a place like we're starting now in temple and monasteries throughout the world where practice is engaged in and valued are not only very rare but extremely helpful to the world because they are helping beings discover that which is not caught in reactive slavery to the forces which really are at the root of all the world's problems. I often think that we're doing radical social action when we're sitting here quietly with our eyes closed, looking at our navels. As many people would think that, you know, what are we doing to help the world? There's a lot of problems out there, and here we come just to feel a bit of spiritual happiness by watching our breath. It seems quite selfish in Hinayana. But actually, when we look at any problem in the world and you trace it back to the actual causes, the fundamental reasons that whatever it is happening, you'll find it's either from greed or from hatred or from delusion, and always, in fact, a mixture to some degree or other of those three. And this is what we're learning to try to uproot, to try to free ourselves from. And in this way, we help the world deeply. And it's an honor then to be part of a community. And I don't mean just the monastic community, the fourfold assembly of practitioners who do value this and want to support it in the kinds of ways that we do. Those of us in the robes, and those of you who come to practice with us and to support this monastery. Tomorrow there'll be a katina ceremony where it's the traditional annual time to come and show support for the monastery. It's a wonderful time because it's a time to reaffirm social connections which value that which goes to the heart and also it directly supports this practice. And it's the main reason I'm interested in helping what we're doing in Temple in New Hampshire as well, a new place. Not that we need to have a new monastery, certainly not that I want to be the abbot of a monastery, but because these places give great benefit to the world, and there aren't many places where people can become monks either. So for these reasons and others, it's an honor to be part of, and so I feel like I have a lot of support in my fellow monks, brothers in conscious benevolent humiliation, and I certainly do feel that quite acutely at times, with all the wonderful things that have happened in New Hampshire. The monastery started in a very good way. Some of you here have really helped it get off the ground, and things have seemed to fall into place in a way which is extraordinarily uplifting. And at the same time, just as I'm sure those of you who've been here, the monks here, the older monks, the younger monks, and those of you who have been supporting the monastery for a long time know, there are challenges involved. There are always challenges. And our challenge is to not mistake the difficulties as some kind of fault or something bad happening, because it's only from difficulty, only when we do get challenged, that we learn. So I just give anamodana to all of you here, and Lumpa Pasano for creating such a place with Ajahn Amaro over the years, and Abhayagiri has a very good reputation in our community as being a place where monks get trained well, and the practice is upheld in a clear and very 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 straight and true manner. And so it's an honor to be here, and also congratulations to Lumpa for he's going to be recognized as a Chaukun coming up. I didn't even know this until I got here. I'd heard a little bit of a rumor, but I didn't know. And so in case you guys don't know, forest monks generally don't care. Traditionally we don't care about these ecclesiastical honors, and yet it's I think it's a good sign that that a monastery such as this and a monk is as fine as Lumpa Pasano, who's created such a good community over so many years, is being honored in this way. So anamodana. Sadhu